Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to mini episode number 14 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Lounge. Managing partner Rick Morris coming at you tonight. We have a very special guest lined up for a discussion this evening. I want to send a great amount of thanks out to the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Servillo, our expert guest booker, for having procured this one here tonight. And it's going to be a real pleasure to have on a very distinguished actor and somebody who has really made quite a career for himself, displaying a lot of versatility along the way and entertaining a whole lot of audiences. He has the distinction of being on two of the biggest sitcoms of the 1980s, and that's something that not a whole lot of people can say when you're looking at two of the leading television programs of a decade. The first one, it was not on the air very long, but I dare say that it, for a show that was only on the air, I believe, two seasons, it's very well remembered in pop culture and really did leave a legacy. Bosom Buddies, that he was on, it was a breakout role for both himself and for Tom Hanks. So that one was the first of the two, and then right on the heels of that, a long stretch as Michael Harris on Newhart during the 1980s, going pretty much through to the end of the decade. And it was a role where he really, we'll talk about this, it was a real zeitgeist kind of a character, much like that of Alex P. Keaton with the yuppie persona that he was giving off during the show. It was really a very interesting one. He's had a great career since, and as I say, has shown a whole lot of versatility as he's gone along with TV, stage, film, voiceover work, kind of similar in some ways. I'm sure we're going to touch on this with him. We had on Curtis Armstrong on the program a couple of months back, and it was the same thing with him. There's a lot of similarities that are almost kind of eerie. They don't have the same kind of TV or film personas per se, although they're both gifted comedic actors, but both of them, having broken through in the same decade, have gone on to carve out long and distinguished careers for themselves, showing a lot of versatility along the way. So in a sense, that discussion provides a little bit of a template for being able to talk to our guest here tonight, because some of the same questions, I think, arise as far as how an actor continues to grow and evolve in his career and in the roles that he plays and the ones that he takes on. And it's going to be a real pleasure to get him on the program here. I understand that we're just about ready to bring him on. I want to thank, while we're at it, by the way, our good friend Russ Cohen and the fellows at Sportsology. It has been great to be able to be hosted on their platform yet again, so it's great to be able to have them on here. They've been very, very hospitable to us here with our mini episodes, and we've been very fortunate to be able to utilize this platform, among others, here as we continue to go along and evolve with the FDH Lounge. But it's a real pleasure to be able to bring on our first guest, and now that he's on the phone lines, right now, I believe he can hear me say what I said previously, that it's a true pleasure to get on somebody on the program that you've seen on TV so much, really, whether it be Bob Barker or the San Diego Chicken or whoever we've had on the show. Anytime it's somebody that you've seen on TV a whole lot, it's always a real thrill to be able to get them on the program. And that would explain why our senior producer, Steve Servillo, went to the length that he did, tracking him down at a theater, I believe, in New Jersey, and giving his standard aggressive guest booking techniques here, and fortunately reeling in this gentleman. And as a child of the 1980s and seeing him in the breakout roles, it's a real thrill for me to bring on the show Peter Scolari. Peter, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. It's good to have you on. Peter? Okay. We're All right, we're working through this. Peter, do we have you on now?
I can hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, sir. Got you on. Great to have you on, sir. How are you this evening?
Oh, nice. Nicely done. Technology.
I'm still working my way through here on the controls, but it's a great thing to have you on the program. I'd like to ask you, and we want to trace through a lot of the things with your career, everything that you've got going on now. But as we were setting it up just a second ago here, of course, the formative roles, the breakthrough roles for you in the 1980s with Bosom Buddies and then Newhart. Trace for us, if you would, what led up to Bosom Buddies. I know you had the Colin Age Theater Lab right there at the outset. Our senior producer, Steve Servillo, wanted me to bring up about Good Time Girls. He said that was probably something that helped you land Bosom Buddies. So talk about what the path was to getting that first breakthrough.
Well, impressive research. You know, when you start touching on stuff I don't remember, that's impressive.
We tried.
I was with a theater company for a little more than 5 years, from 74 to 79, an incredible group, which included actors who came through with Jeff Goldblum, Danny DeVito, Rhea Perlman, my buddy Michael O'Keefe. The artistic director of the company certainly had an eye for talent. Despite that, he brought me into the company, and I had I was really groomed and brought up, you know, by older actors, who some of whom were rough, you know, had rough sensibilities, and you know, once I kind of made my mark as a 19-20-year-old actor, they stopped treating me like a kid, you know, and they could be, some of the older actors got strong with me. You know, I mean, we weren't physically fighting, but this is a bunch of Italian-Americans, Irish-Italian, Irish-Catholic-Americans, and a lot of strong personalities. So, you know, I really learned at a very young age I kind of had to fend for myself. In some instances, you know, folks were either with you or against you. In 79, a lot of folks had gone off to Hollywood, O'Keefe, Danny DeVito went out to do Taxi, and Rhea Perlman followed him out there. Obviously, they'd been living together for a number of years. I used to watch their apartment in New York when Danny went out in the mid-70s to do Cuckoo's Nest, for example, with a couple other actors from the Colonnades, Vinny Schiavelli and a couple other guys, Vinny, who passed away not long ago. So I had a snobbish attitude, Rick, and I said, I'm not going out to Hollywood. I'm not selling out. I'm going to be part of the theater community here and make my way. And, you know, if Hollywood wants me, they can fly me out. That was my arrogant 24-year-old attitude. And, you know, in the spring of 79, I tested for a pilot for NBC, Paramount NBC. And, indeed, I didn't get the part out of New York, but I was flown from New York to Los Angeles and continued to audition and test for the role, and I got it. So there I was, flown out and embarrassed by my arrogance, but suddenly sitting in, you know, sleeping on DeVito's couch and then other couches, as we do when we're young actors sometimes. And I began. I was replaced in this pilot. The pilot sold for a series. It was called The Further Adventures of Wally Brown. We'll talk to Steve Servillo, who probably know better than I.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only job I've ever been fired from, because my agent was told we didn't want him to be the funny one. He's supposed to be the straight guy. But nobody told me that. And then I was rehired to play my role when they couldn't successfully replace me. And then the pilot disappeared. It didn't. The series commitment did not hold. And I was ready to turn around and head out, head back to Brooklyn. I was living with a woman in Brooklyn and was happy to come back to my haunt. But I got a guest starring role with Donna Pascal and dear friend Bob Hayes on their show Angie. And then the producers of that show asked me to join the cast of this thing that Steve brought up, the Good Time Girl. And I filmed 12 episodes of The Good Time Girls, made a very close friendship with my friend Adrian Zemed. We're still very close geez, 32 years later, 33, oh my, 33 years later. I remember when I thought 33 was you know, a grown-up, and now I have clothing that's 33 years old.
I miss those days, Peter.
How old are you? You don't mind me asking, do you?
Few years older than 33, but enough to so that it's painful.
I touched a nerve here. I'm going to leave it alone. I just turned 56, so I'm feeling healthier and happier than when I was 46. So I guess I'm going to run with that.
That's the progression you want, no question.
Hopefully, I'll get through this tiresome biography I'm giving you. But you asked me. Problem with actors is if you ask them to talk about themselves, they will. So
you're giving us a great one, and you mentioned a number of interesting names there. I got a side question for you for a second because
it's been our experience
in doing the show how incestuous the entertainment industry is, the degrees of separation, folks who've worked with folks. I'm curious. Our senior editor Jason Jones brought it to my attention. His uncle actually is one of the premier stage actors, certainly in the eastern part of the country. I know you've done a lot of stage work. And I mention
indeed.
This because he's also very good friends with, and I guess was a mentor to at one time, your old cohort, Tom Hanks. Have you ever had the occasion to work with Alan Rust on stage?
No, but I know the name, of course, from Tom. And there are a couple of other folks, this gentleman, I remember his name among them, to whom Tom pays tribute, you know, and pays his homage to them, you know, as folks. His high school drama teacher, whose name now eludes me. A fellow who hired him, to be a journeyman at the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival back
mm-hmm.
in the late 70s. These guys, Tom will tell you, they sort of founded. I don't mean found like, oh, here's a guy. He's got something special. They, you know, I share this with the folks I would pay homage to. They groomed us and trained us. Gave us skill sets that would otherwise have been unavailable. You can't, you know, as a young actor or a young musician or any other performing artist, you can't say, oh, gee, I think I'll learn how to do, you know, do this, that, or the other thing and just go grab it for yourself. Or in our modern era, you can't Google, you know, a skill set for a young actor or musician and just take it off the web. So it ends
true.
Up being... It's a long, you know, ancient history of apprenticeship, really, where you know, if you're lucky, you find mentors and masters, and they pass it on. And I had that experience. Tom did, too.
That's amazing, a lot of the great names that you've had a chance to work with. And, of course, you know, with Bosom Buddies, that being where you and Tom took off. I found out in the course of the research that I did here, I didn't realize that having gotten rerun in the summer of 84, I guess, by NBC, that there was talk of possibly getting a run there, but you were already, I guess, ensconced at Newhart by that time. Is it one of those deals where it was kind of like a bird in the hand? You already had something pretty good going at that point.
Well, sure, but the thing is, honestly, the research is sound, but I'll give you the inside on that, which goes to Brandon Tartikoff, who was the president of NBC at that time, and I think you'd see if you looked at the timeline in Tom's filmography, you'd see that
mm-hmm.
somewhere around late 83, 84 was Splash, which Daryl Hannah, Ronnie Howard's movie, which was a big hit. And then Tom, it led to something right away that was in production or was released in the spring or thereabouts of 84, and so Brandon Tartikoff actually held a press conference. He said, I'm going to bring Bosom Buddies back in prime time. It'll be reruns, but I'm going to bring it back in prime time because of the success of, quote, one of its stars. Currently, you know, the current success of one of its stars. And I ran into Brandon Tartikoff at some event later that year, and I said, hey, thanks for the nod. thanks for mentioning why you brought the show back, having nothing to do with me, you know, trundling my way through my early years at the Newhart show. But there were sort of rumors and words being bandied about that, you know, well, why not do Bosom Buddies the movie? And Tom and I certainly had a couple of laughs talking about that. over the years. In the early 90s, I actually pitched an idea for a movie, Bosom Buddies, to Tom, and he really liked it. And I'm sure would never have done it. You know, here he was at that time in the early 90s. We were seeing the emergence of a profound dramatic actor. So that's not the time to go do Bosom Buddies the movie. So I don't think it was ever meant to be.
It was, but something that I found interesting, though, is that you've worked on some projects with him subsequently. So I mean, that's got to be great to be able to revisit. You know, somebody that you came up with, and you know, with a lot of the different roles that you've played. I imagine a lot of the different things that he's got out there. There's probably any number of roles that a guy like you is versatile enough to play. So that must be pretty funny or pretty fun to get to do that again and work with him when the chance presents itself.
In one instance, I think it was that thing you do, that I was just a last-minute replacement. An actor had dropped out of a role in that film, and Tom and Gary Getzman, his partner, out of Playtone Productions, called and said, "Will you get on a plane tonight? Will you be on set tomorrow?" I said, "Of course." And they fixed my car. I remember when I was in lieu of any kind of salary, I had some problems with the gas tank in this old car I had, and they had some Teamsters take it out when we were at lunch one day, and when I went to the parking lot at the end of the day, my car didn't fix. It's, you know, Tom and I, we used to joke about it, and as we get older now, it's an undeniable fact that Tom and Peter are closer friends than the Bosom Buddies ever were. And, you know, not having to deal with the constraints of living half of our lives in drag either. Well, I can say that for myself. I can't vouch for Tom. You'll have to ask him, but as far as I know, he stays fully clothed in men's attire.
Let's hope so. Anyways, but as far as it goes with your leading characters in the 80s, there, I mean, I'm gonna guess that you know, when you get stopped on the street or asked about roles, I'm gonna guess that as memorable as Henry/Hildegard was, that probably in more instances than not, that it would be Michael Harris that gets brought up to you. I mean, that was such a zeitgeist character for the decade, wasn't it? With the kind of spoiled yuppie thing going, almost kind of a counterpoint to Alex P. Keaton. What's it like to play a character like that? That's just supposed to embody so much of what's going on in pop culture at the time.
Wow, that's a question that's so much smarter than I am. I almost have to ask for a replay, but let me give it a try. The first part of the question is, I think the answer is that I'm recognized more often for this sort of, you might say, this video glut. I've done 300 or more individual television episodes.
Sure.
And the nature of reruns and syndication being what it is, whether people like it or not, they have seen me as they're falling asleep or channel surfing, and in as many instances have sat and watched a rerun cycle of Bosom Buddies or Newhart. Back in the late 90s and through till 2000 or 2001, I did a television version of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids as a TV series for Disney.
Right.
And I like to refer to that era as Honey, I Shrunk My Career, because I made a lot of money, but the show was, you know, running on Sunday afternoons and Saturday afternoons, and it was a family market. It was not a first-run network, you know, primetime show ever.
Mm-hmm.
So as successful as a lot of these Disney Channel, Disney television franchises have been for the young actors, for a guy who did a show like that, and we're very proud of the episodes, the 66 one-hour episodes we made, by the way, Rick, but it created a sort of cast, I think, in a lot of people's minds in television that said, well, he's not primetime. You know, he's become a family television actor. And, you know, that may or may not be true. What's developed since then, you know, it's taken more time where I'm at in the kind of TV work I'm getting now and some film work and a lot of stage work the last 5 years. I have no complaints, but it was a very rough go from 2000 to 2004. And all that being said, it's that Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. When I walk around the streets of New York, as I am right now as we speak, it's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. There's 66 hours of them out there in the ethernet. Now, you get somebody, you know, who's 30, 35, 40, I can begin to tell. I ask them how old they are when they stop me on the street, and I can, and from that I can ascertain. If somebody says, "Oh, I'm 42, and I used to watch you when I was, and before, you know," they're doing some sort of hand gesture that shows me how tall they were when they watched me. And I've become like a carnival psychic. I can tell them, "Oh, you watch Bosom Buddies. You're 43 and 5'9", 162 pounds.
That's very interesting. I mean, it just goes to show that no two stories are exactly the same, because the one thing I was thinking coming into this as far as a precedent with our show, we had Curtis Armstrong around a couple months ago, and I asked him the same question. And, you know, for him, he said, you know, it's mostly booger, but, you know, occasionally some other ones. So it's very interesting because you and he both have really shown a lot of versatility after coming up in the 80s and really working in different platforms, stage, you know, TV, film, both doing voiceovers. So it's interesting that you get a little bit more variety in terms of what people bring up to you versus not so much with him. It's just that's what makes it so fascinating to talk to guys in your business. Everybody's got a different story to tell.
Yeah. It's amazing you mention him, because I had left the Colonnade Theater in 79 and was set to embark upon a TV career. But I was back in New York in 1980 briefly, and there was a play in production at my old theater company, and Curtis Armstrong was the young lead in it. So I came and saw it, and I thought he was great, so we met. 1980, and years and years later, I guess maybe it was in the post-moonlighting, if I'm not mistaken. We ran into each other, and I think reflected upon that.
Well, you know, I said to him, I'm the one person in a million that's going to tell you this, but I told him, I said, he'll always be Herb from Moonlighting to me. I said, because I was a huge Moonlighting mark back in the day, so I'm the one guy that thinks of that well before Booger. I realize that some of his other roles tend to come up before that when people think of him. But as far as folks that you've worked with or crossed paths with in any way, something else that came up in the research that just really fascinated me, because somebody that when we go back to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, writer for that show, Ed Ferrara, who would go on to become just one of the groundbreaking pro wrestling writers / bookers of the late 90s, the Attitude Era, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, D-Generation X, all this wild and crazy stuff that really helped turn the wrestling industry on its ear. Did you ever see any hint of anything like that when he was writing for your show?
He was wrestling. He was dabbling as a sort of semi-professional. He was doing it himself.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't see where it was going for him as a writer. I thought he had quite a bit of promise as a writer. He didn't have a lot of what the studio wanted from him, Buena Vista Television and Disney. They wanted him to kind of really get what you might call a bunch of running gags, things that the hooks, you know, like a Motown riff that brings you into My Guy. We know what the song is when we hear the hook, the riff, you know. And they wanted that equivalent from him in the writing. And he didn't produce that for them, and which didn't concern me at all. I thought the guy was outlandishly funny and creative, and a very good-hearted guy. I thought he didn't really catch a break there. And they tried to make him into something that he wasn't, you know, a more kind of standard, you know, by the numbers, you know, Disney family franchise kind of TV writer, and he had other plans. So I don't know if they let him go, but, you know, it was a very strong executive producership there with John Landis and his partner, Leslie Bellsberg. You know, and I got along great with those guys, but they were, you know, it was their way or the highway.
Well, that's a great insight there you give us in terms of the comparison between the TV business and pro wrestling, because, I mean, he was pretty nonlinear in wrestling here, but I guess wrestling is a little friendlier to being reinvented with the kind of stuff that he and his partner Vince Russo were helping to bring in. That is interesting. As we start to
move
a little bit closer,
I didn't even know any of that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Great. I didn't even know any of that, and it's great. You know that they needed him. They needed that fresh, you know, and sort of bent. I mean, he was bent in the head in a really lovely way. And what
I guess it just goes to show. I mean, we all end up where we belong eventually, Peter, huh?
I hope so. And I'm experiencing that now. But I may not be as optimistic or at least as certain as you are. I'm hopeful that that's true. Some people say life is what happens while you're making other plans. I believe that's often the case.
Yeah, that's a very profound saying. I've heard that before. As we move a little closer to present day here in our allotted time remaining, Peter, I know you've got Batman, the Brave, and the Bold going on here, and some other projects. And as I alluded to, similar to Curtis Armstrong, I mean, you've really done it all over a period of time here. A lot of stage work as well, voiceover work with Pinky and the Brain, Duckman, Scooby-Doo, et cetera. So, I mean, what are some of the things you've got on your plate as you're heading into the future here? I mean, you've always got stuff going on seemingly. So, what are the big things to you right now?
Thanks for asking. You know, I'm in a sort of casting pool now in New York theater and Broadway. It took me out to, I was happy to go out and do summer theater in Maine this year. I played the Music Man up in Maine. What a joy. And that's it's a direct result of being active on Broadway here in the last 5-6 years. And there hasn't been a lot of TV and film production in New York until the last year or so. And I'm finding myself in a sort of entree position there, and I just finished the first season of a new series for HBO called Girls, which has been created by this wonderful woman, Lena Dunham. And I, along with another Broadway actress, Broadway veteran, Becky Ann Baker, who's Dylan Baker's wife, she and I play the mom and dad to Lena Dunham's lead character in this new series for HBO. It's very, I hesitate to say it's kinky or edgy because those apply to certain other shows that will remain nameless on Showtime.
Sure.
and HBO, but Lena is writing in an author, to use the pretentious term. She's creating a world that somehow seems very real to you, not a construction. I love Bored to Death, for example, on HBO, Zach Galifianakis and Ted Danson. And the wonderful guy, Jason Schwartzman, who's created it. But it's not real. It's a construction. And it's one of Hung is a construction. Weeds is a construction. And what's happening with Girls, and also I'm seeing it with Laura Dern's new series, which is just coming on just ahead of us on HBO, really kind of reaching into, the reality pocket and seeing what kind of loose change we have as an audience. And so there is edginess, but that's not a hook of the show. And there is kinkiness and a lot of sexuality in these young 20-something characters, but that's not the hook of the show. It's my girlfriend Tracy and I watched it, the pilot, a few weeks ago, and we said, my God, this is a non-TV show. You'd almost believe that was the plan. Let's do a non-TV show. And I don't mean the way in which Seinfeld was a show about nothing. But that's the thing. If you go anywhere and do anything when you're thinking about, yours truly, I hope you see this show on HBO, and I'm so excited to be a part of it. And it's not the kind of thing that I've done. I mean, when have we ever seen me in a wild sex scene, fully naked in a shower? Not often.
I can't wait to check it out. Just to see the continuing evolution of what you've got going on is going to be tremendous. Peter, I've had a lot of fun. I know the audience has as well. I feel like we only really got to scratch the surface of everything with you here. We'd love to have you back sometime soon and continue catching up with you, sir.
I love it. Thanks. I know I went on a lot, but you made me comfortable, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. I really would love to do some more with you sometime soon here and catch up some more. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Really appreciate it.
Back at you, pal.
All right. Thanks so much. All right.
That's
the great Peter Scolari, everybody. We're very appreciative of having him on the program here tonight. And we're going to be coming back at you again with mini-episode 15 of the FDH Lounge this weekend here, the FantasyDraftHelp.com Insider, giving you your Sunday start and sit tips for the NFL. So signing off for right now, this has been Forrest. We really appreciate having Peter Scolari on with us here. It was mini episode 14 of the FDH Lounge.